very key role in this case. You know, Mattis was the person who most memorably in this case dismissed the charges against one of the Marines, a man named Lance Corporal Justin Sherritt. Sherritt is the one who killed three members of 14-year-old Khalid Jamal's family. And Mattis didn't just dismiss the charges, he also wrote Sherritt a very glowing, full of praise letter, saying that in his eyes, Sherritt was innocent, and praising Sherritt for how he had performed as a Marine. And, you know, this is something that Mattis, I think, to this day, it appears is very proud of. In his memoir, he even published the letter in his book.
And at this point, no one went to jail, Madeline. We have 15 seconds.
Correct. No punishment, no jail time for the killings to this day. That's correct.
And the response of the Iraqis, the family members who survived?
What they want is the world to know what happened to their family, to know what their family were good people, not insurgents, and they want justice.
Madeline Barron, I want to thank you for an astounding podcast series, In the Dark, head reporter and host of the New Yorker podcast. The new article in the New Yorker is The Haditha Massacre Photos That the Military Didn't Want the World to See. We will link to it all. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Thanks for joining us.
You are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Go to kboo.fm/wakeup to support KBOO during our Wake Up the Neighborhood fall membership drive by grabbing limited edition KBOO merch. You can support local community radio in style with your choice of t-shirt and hoodies in pavement black, snow white, oregano green, cherry red, and sandy beach. That's kboo.fm/wakeup to get yours before they're gone.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this special membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, drug recriminalization takes effect in Oregon. Advocates weigh in on changing the Northwest Forest Plan. And in international news, a far-right party in Germany wins big in the recent election. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 3rd, 2024. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Eric Leuschner. Oregon House Bill 4002 took effect on Sunday, recriminalizing drugs throughout the state and effectively ending the decriminalization experiment voters passed in Measure 110. Counties are supposed to have deflection centers prepared to direct people who are caught in possession of drugs towards treatment. Multnomah County's deflection center is delayed until at least October, and officials say there will be mobile deflection in the meantime. In the first 2 days since the law took effect, Portland police arrested 4 people for drug possession. They are now in detention at the county jail. 2 others qualified for deflection and services, and 1 other was given a citation instead of an arrest. The U.S. Forest Service is considering changes to modernize the Northwest Forest Plan. While it was hailed as a success when it was created 30 years ago, the Forest Service wants to update the plan to address new challenges to the region. To help with the process, the agency convened an advisory committee, which unanimously approved 192 recommendations for the plan. Suzanne Jane Brown with the nonprofit environmental law firm Silvix Resources co-chaired the committee and says, "Tribal inclusion and rights were among the most critical issues to address because they weren't included in the original plan."
That was a pretty substantial oversight and something that the Federal Advisory Committee wanted to correct this time around. We really wanted to center Indigenous perspectives and Indigenous knowledge in the management of these forests.
The plan guides management of more than 19 million acres of land across Washington, Oregon, and Northern California. The Forest Service is moving forward with the amendment process for the plan. Brown says a draft impact statement was expected in August, but that has been pushed back. The agency is incorporated the committee's recommendations for a draft analysis as well as other alternatives. The Forest Service is looking to address three threats: invasive species, particularly large and severe wildfires, and climate change. Brown says these issues need to be addressed quickly.
Our forests and communities are in desperate need of clear management direction. Given the wildfire crisis, given the climate crisis that we're also experiencing right now, so we really need an updated management plan that is equipped to deal with those new challenges.
Travis Joseph is the head of the American Forest Resource Council and also co-chaired the Federal Advisory Committee. He says the committee gathered diverse interests and did the hard work to collaborate on their recommendations to the Forest Service.
There is a path forward, and we can move beyond the hyperbole and the quote-unquote forest wars of the past. And if we focus on what we have in common and the outcomes that we want to achieve, we can move beyond the past and frankly build a brighter future.
Following the U.S. Supreme Court's overturning of a 40-year-old decision, courts could have more power in how federal agencies operate, including those that oversee public lands and wildlife. Kathleen Shannon has more in Wyoming.
A recent U.S. Supreme Court decision could impact public lands and wildlife in places like Wyoming. In June, the nation's highest court overruled a nearly 40-year-old practice known as Chevron deference, which says that when it comes to interpreting a vague law, courts should defer to agency expertise instead of interpreting law themselves. That practice has given agencies like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which oversees endangered species, Forest Service, and Bureau of Land Management flexibility in making decisions on how vague law plays out. The new decision tilts the scales, giving courts the final say on ambiguous statutes. University of Wyoming College of Law's Sam Kalin says the decision is far-reaching.
That means there's going to be more power, more ability of a court to potentially do something that is, you know, against the entire purpose, if you will, even of the Endangered Species Act.
In the court's majority opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote, "Chevron kept judges from judging." In dissent, Justice Kagan said it supported regulatory efforts of all kinds, including those that keep air and water clean, food and drugs safe, and financial markets honest. 70 U.S. Supreme Court decisions and 17,000 lower court decisions have invoked Chevron. Kalin says the new decision could upset old ones.
But what we have seen in the last, I would say, couple months is a lot of instances where parties are trying to now re-argue issues where Chevron was used as a framework in the past. And to me, that could be significant.
He says it's too soon to tell if revisiting old court decisions will become a trend. I'm Kathleen Shannon reporting for Wyoming News Service.
Women are in four of Oregon's five statewide elected positions, far higher than the national average. But as Eric Tegedoff reports, that number will go down after November's election.
Oregon is in the upper echelon when it comes to the number of women in higher office. Four of the five statewide elected positions in the state are held by women, including Tina Kotek in the governor's office. That's a rare achievement. Director of the Center for American Women in Politics, Debbie Walsh, says the national average for women in statewide elected offices is about 1 in 3. However, the number of women in these positions in Oregon is guaranteed to go down in November, with men running in two of the five positions. Walsh says this is the nature of politics.
No state can just say, well, we fixed the problem of women's underrepresentation in politics. We don't need to do the work of recruiting and supporting women to run. That work is ongoing.
Men will be facing off in Oregon's Secretary of State and Attorney General races in November. But Walsh notes that the state has set a high bar elsewhere, too. Women hold half of its congressional seats, and women are in a little more than 40% of the seats in the state legislature. Walsh says women face a number of barriers to office. While they raise comparable amounts of money to men running in comparable races, they are less likely to self-fund their campaigns. She says women are more dependent on small donors, which can be good because it means more people are investing in the campaign.
The flip side of that is that the amount of time and energy and work that it takes to raise $1,000 is just exponentially higher and harder for a candidate who is more dependent on those low-level dollars or those low-dollar donations.
Women running for office has become a big storyline this year with Vice President Kamala Harris's run for president. Walsh says if she wins, it will be a big breakthrough for women, especially women of color.
The only downside to seeing a woman elected at the very top is that people then think that the problem is solved because we've elected a woman president of the United States. And complacency will not get us to gender equity across levels of office.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The cap on prescription drug costs for Medicare enrollees will save people an average of $1,500 starting in 2025, according to a new report from AARP. Suzanne Potter reports from Sacramento.
Hundreds of thousands of older Californians will see huge savings on prescription drugs starting in January, according to a new report from AARP. The Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act caps prescription drug costs at $2,000 per year for people on Medicare, starting in 2025. Nina Weiler-Harwell with AARP says an estimated 271,000 people in the Golden State will hit the out-of-pocket maximum next year.
Medicare drug plan enrollees nationwide who reach the new out-of-pocket cap will see an average savings of roughly $1,500 or 56% in 2025 for new prescription drugs.
On average, 40% of people on Medicare who reach the cap will save at least $1,000 a year, and 12% will see savings of more than $3,000. Every year from 2025 to 2029, between 3 and 4 million Part D plan enrollees are estimated to benefit from the new out-of-pocket cap. Weiler-Harwell says the Inflation Reduction Act introduced a number of new policies to cut costs for Americans on Medicare.
Copays for insulin capped at $35 a month. Vaccines such as shingles and pneumonia are free. The Inflation Reduction Act did allow Medicare to negotiate the price of high-cost prescription drugs, so we won't really start to do that until 2026.
Also, thanks to the IRA, drug companies will have to pay a penalty if they raise their prices higher than inflation. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Fallen sergeant's family confronts VP Harris. Utah pushes to toss maps. And Virginia workers fear Project 2025. With more on these stories, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Vice President Harris, I ask you, why won't you return a call and explain to us how you call my daughter-in-law's death a success?
Christy Shamblin, mother-in-law of a sergeant buried at Arlington, is criticizing Kamala Harris over the vice president's charge that former President Donald Trump used the cemetery as a backdrop for a political stunt. The Trump campaign may have broken a law against staging partisan events there. But in a video reposted by Trump's VP pick, Shamblin said Harris should launch another investigation into the withdrawal from Afghanistan 3 years ago. The White House has said the withdrawal fulfilled a commitment made by Trump and was a success in that the nation is better off for having ended the war. House Speaker Mike Johnson visited Cleveland to raise funds against an anti-gerrymandering amendment on the Ohio ballot, which would give redistricting power to a citizen board rather than lawmakers.
When politicians are in charge of drawing maps, both parties will rig them for their favor. They take away our choice, they take away our power.
Jen Miller with the League of Women Voters says it's enormously popular, having gotten support from 500,000 voters. Meanwhile, the Utah Supreme Court threw out district maps that favored Republicans, returning the issue to a lower court. The unanimous opinion ruled the legislature ignored an independent redistricting commission created by voters in 2018. For now, the maps are unchanged, and it's not clear if new districts can be drawn for this fall's election. Elections experts are warning of election denialism in the battleground of Arizona. Alex Gulotta, with All Voting is Local Action, says some candidates are already saying that if they don't win, it's because of fraud.
The election is the people saying who won, and people can't say ahead of time that the only way there's a fair election is if I win. And we've just had a lot of that in recent years.
Folks who feel disillusioned about politics should go to the polls in 2 months for their long-term health, according to the American Medical Association. University of North Dakota social work professor Craig Burns unpacks the research.
Whether people have access to an affordable grocery store that sells healthy produce, or whether they have access to safe transportation.
Project 2025, the right-wing roadmap for a second Trump administration, envisions firing tens of thousands of federal employees. That's drawing attention in Virginia, home to over 140,000 federal workers. Republicans argue unelected bureaucrats have too much power. But Donald Sherman with watchdog group Crew says agencies depend on the technical knowledge of nonpartisan professionals.
You can understand why you want to have government food inspectors or government highway technicians who have not just years but decades of expertise and, you know, have loyalty to their craft as opposed to loyalty to a particular politician.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $30,000 by September 21st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 60 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be hot and sunny with a high of 92 degrees. Today in history, in 1935, Sir Malcolm Campbell reaches a speed of 304 miles per hour driving on the Bonneville Salt Flats in Utah, becoming the first person to drive a car over 300 miles per hour. The quote of the day is from American architect Louis Sullivan, who said, quote, "An architect, to be a true exponent of his time, must possess first, last, and always the sympathy, the intuition of a poet. This is the one real, vital principle that survives through all places and all times." First Nations leaders are reacting to the sentencing of a serial killer in Manitoba, Canada, who killed four Indigenous women. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. First Nations leaders in Canada are reacting to the sentencing of a Manitoba serial killer who murdered four Indigenous women. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, Jeremy Skibitsky was sentenced last week to four life sentences with no chance of parole for 25 years.
The 37-year-old Skibitsky appeared to be without emotion in the prisoner's box of the Manitoba Court of King's Bench during the sentencing. He had been found guilty in July of the murders of four Indigenous women, Morgan Harris, Mercedes Myron, Rebecca Contois, and an unidentified victim given the name of Buffalo Woman. He was sentenced for each of the four counts of first-degree murder. The sentences in Canada are served concurrently rather than consecutively. That means an automatic life sentence of 25 years with no parole. Skibitsky won't be able to apply for parole until he is 60 years old. Cindy Woodhouse-Nepinak is the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations. She says her heart still hurts for the families of the victims.
I want to uplift the families. I know that it's been a long, hard-fought battle, and I want to lift them up for trying to fight so hard to get justice for their families. It shouldn't have taken so much political pressure. And they stayed steadfast through it, and I lift them up in a good way. And I think that no other family should have to go through what these families have endured.
The court heard during the trial how Skibitsky preyed on Indigenous women at homeless shelters, invited them back to his apartment, and abused them. Then he killed them and disposed of their bodies in garbage bins and dumpsters. Sheila North is a former Grand Chief in Manitoba.
This is a very clear example of the problem that persists in Canada, that societal problem. And this, unfortunately, is still happening today. People targeting Indigenous women just because of their vulnerability, just because of their social status and what people perceive of who we are as Indigenous women and girls and two-spirited people.
In a statement, the Grand Chief of the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs, Kathy Merrick, said the killings left a deep scar on First Nations people and the reverberations will be felt for generations. The Crown Prosecutor said Skibitsky can never be punished enough for his crimes. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A new program at Arizona State University will help tribes with resources and support to establish a plan for digital sovereignty. Mark Richardson has more.
ASU's Center for Tribal Digital Sovereignty is designed to help Native Americans plan and develop their digital footprint. The project is a joint effort between the American Indian Policy Institute and ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. Gracie Morris is the executive director of the project. She says it's all about providing full access to the digital universe.
It encompasses the exercise of sovereign authority over physical and virtual infrastructure and the tangible, intangible, and virtual digital jurisdictional aspects of acquisition, storage, transmission, and use of data.
Morris says developing a platform for digital information is critical to tribal autonomy. The program will support tribes in Arizona and across the U.S. in achieving equal access to the governance, social, and economic advantages of broadband and other technologies. Morris says digital sovereignty encompasses all aspects of a tribal nation's digital plan and footprint.
The point is to enable tribes to be able to implement the best thing that they can and exercise their digital sovereignty so that they can serve their members. For the end user, they should be able to have the same access as theoretically you or I have in a city.
Morris says broadband and other communications technologies are a necessary 21st century platform for tribal independence. She believes establishment of the center is a significant turning point for Native Americans. Mark Richardson reporting.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Congress is looking to improve pay and benefits for federal workers. Government agencies have struggled with attracting and retaining talent, so lawmakers are looking to improve hiring practices, salaries, and benefits for civil servants. Will Walkie reports.
Federal lawmakers will debate a number of bills this fall designed to improve hiring, retention, and benefits for government workers. Their proposals come as agencies and departments struggle with understaffing, plus gaps in knowledge or skills among their employees. Max Steyer with the Partnership for Public Service says one issue is a lack of young people in government positions.
Right now, it's 7% of the workforce, or thereabouts, is under the age of 30 in the federal government. That number drops to closer to 4% in the technology area.
Congress is expected to consider changes to the federal hiring process, which currently takes more than double the time of the private sector. A 2% pay bump could also be on the horizon, as well as expanding paid leave for reserve military members. Virginia politicians have often been a voice for federal workers, given the Commonwealth's high number of government employees. Democrat Representative Abigail Spanberger is leading the charge to increase Social Security benefits for millions of Americans, including many current or former public servants. Steyer says beyond adding incentives to hire and retain talent, the federal government needs to improve internal practices, starting at the leadership level. Internal communication pipelines, technology, and customer service centers are often outdated, which ultimately harms the public.
Americans want a government that's not political. They want a government that's serving them better. They want the expertise that the system is supposed to be based on, but they don't think they're getting that in most instances. And that lack of trust leads to sometimes a buy-in for bad solutions.
Former President Donald Trump has proposed eliminating or altering thousands of government positions if he wins this November. Another likely debate this fall will be over remote work. Some lawmakers want federal employees to spend more time in the office rather than working from home. I'm Will Walkie, Virginia News Connection.
The far right has won a state victory in Germany for the first time since World War II. The Anti-Immigration Alternative for Deutschland, or AfD, party received almost one-third of the parliament vote in the state of Thuringia, far ahead of Germany's three governing parties. The AfD still has little chance of establishing a government there because other parties refuse to work with it. Apparently, unhappiness with a national government notorious for infighting, inflation, a weak economy, anti-immigration sentiment, and skepticism towards German military aid for Ukraine are among the factors that contributed to the party support. AfD is particularly strong in eastern Germany. Branches in both Saxony and Thuringia have been under official surveillance as proven right-wing extremist groups. Its top candidate in Thuringia, Bjorn Höcke, has been convicted of knowingly using a Nazi slogan at political events. Höcke did secure a parliament seat. Höcke said, quote, "Please stop stigmatizing me. We are the number one party in Thuringia. You don't want to classify one-third of the voters in Thuringia as right-wing extremists." End quote. The voting took place on the 85th anniversary of Nazi Germany's invasion of Poland at the start of World War II. Far-left protesters demonstrated against AfD in Hamburg, Dresden, and Leipzig. Older Germans who lived through the Nazi era appear to be frightened. Holocaust survivor Charlotte Knobloch, president of the Jewish community of Munich and Upper Bavaria, also cautioned against labeling AfD's successes as an aberration. Gudrun Pfeiffer, a retiree, said Sunday's vote brought back grim memories from early childhood days during and after World War II. Pfeiffer said, quote, "I know what this can all lead to," end quote. AfD's popularity among younger voters is particularly worrying. 38% of people aged between 18 and 24 voted for the far-right party in Thuringia, compared to 33% overall. The Harris-Walz campaign strategy emphasizes values and ideals rather than policy. Returning to normalcy in politics and redefining patriotism in support of democracy are themes they hope will resonate with a public that has had enough of Donald Trump's chaos and vindictiveness, as well as the threat to democracy posed by Project 2025. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. On January 20, 1961, John F. Kennedy inspired millions with his inaugural address. He said, "The torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans, whom he urged to participate more deeply in solving the nation's problems." This appeal to citizenship may seem old-fashioned today, yet most of the speakers at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago recently, starting with Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, seem to be trying out a new version of Kennedy's approach. They too say the torch has been passed to a new generation. This time around, however, a Democratic leadership will have a very different and much more challenging political environment than was true in Kennedy's time. After a decade of Donald Trump's antics, Democratic leaders are urging a return to normalcy, which calls for decency and integrity in our political discourse, and embrace of patriotism in defense of democracy, the Constitution, and American values. Their strategy is clear: emphasize shared ideals and spirit rather than partisan policies. The Democratic Party would have us be more joyful, but the practical immediate aim is to end Donald Trump's politics of chaos, his constant lying and promises of retribution, and the threats to dismantle government agencies that are featured in Project 2025. Normalcy must return in the way we conduct our politics. That means restoring and expanding voting rights, trusting civil servants to do their job, and avoiding a repetition of the 2020 episodes of election interference. Harris and Walz propose a politics of healing based on inclusiveness, mutual respect, and genuine bipartisanship in legislation. Kamala's promise to appoint a Republican to a cabinet position is in keeping with her commitment. Republicans who have rejected Trump are mobilizing. They represent the kind of independent thinking that used to reside in their party. In focusing on patriotism, Harris and Walz seem to take away what has long been a Republican monopoly on flag and national identity. True patriotism means loyalty to country, not party or individual, to democracy, not autocracy, and to upholding the Constitution and the rule of law. Notice that Kamala Harris very specifically said she was speaking as an American, not party leader, at the convention. She wants us to get back to identifying ourselves as citizens who feel privileged to live in a democracy where all may benefit. In terms of issues, Harris and Walz offer populist policies that emphasize more opportunities for the middle class and those who aspire to join it, such as affordable housing and tax reductions, and taxing the rich to pay for social programs. Their full agenda reflects opinion polls that show that Americans, by a wide margin, support more gun control laws, legal abortion, student debt relief, same-sex marriage, free pre-K schooling, and the minimum wage. In short, a central role for government in providing essential services for all. Nevertheless, the DNC did not adequately address some issues. Hardly anything was said about the climate crisis or other major environmental problems. That's odd, given very strong public support for climate change action and a green economy. Corporate power was left largely untouched, except with respect to Big Farm. The decisive role of political action committees and billionaires' money in politics was not discussed, no doubt because of the huge influx of contributions the Harris-Walz team is receiving. Foreign policy at the DNC was mainly sloganeering, particularly with respect to national defense. Once again, a Democratic candidate felt compelled to say she supports the greatest military machine the world has ever seen. That means still more money in the military budget and more weapons, including nuclear weapons, in the U.S. arsenal. Harris addressed the horrific war in the Middle East with the usual Biden formula: a ceasefire, but not a permanent ceasefire, priority to defense of Israel, with no stated limit on U.S. weapons transfers, and due regard to Palestinian losses and self-determination, but without calling for statehood as a condition of a peace agreement. A particular note is that the DNC organizers rejected having any Palestinian-American address the convention, even though, according to one report I've seen, the parents of the American hostage who did speak advocated for a Palestinian speaker. In all, Harris gave no indication that Joe Biden's policies would change on Israel, Ukraine, Iran, China, Venezuela, or any other country or international issue. But since polls indicate that foreign policy is the least important issue for Americans these days, I suppose we should have low expectations of initiatives. Policy proposals are not, however, central to the DNC program. For Harris and Waltz, they are secondary to the task of designing an American agenda, one that restores sanity, decency, and fair play to the conduct of politics. Values and ideals first, they're saying. Given the huge gap in understanding about what it means to be an American, that's probably a good idea. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 3rd, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Will Walkie, Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Kathleen Shannon, and Suzanne Potter. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership